Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome back to the Irish Economics Podcast. Today I am joined by Owen McLaughlin of UCC. Owen's work has covered economic history and environmental sustainability. One of the most interesting things about Owen's work is that a lot of it helps us to understand the current COVID pandemic that we're currently going through. We discuss a piece of research he has been carrying out with Chris Colvin at Queen's in Belfast on how to best capture the debt toll associated with the Spanish flu, and he applies this concept to the COVID numbers in Ireland. In essence, he finds that age is important, and if properly taken into account, the headline results can be very different. So that's a very interesting conclusion, and we go through the details of that piece of research. We then go on to discuss a paper he's written on Irish land bonds of the early 20th century. Essentially, these are loans given to Irish farmers, but were backed by the UK government in various sort of agreements and hybrid agreements. This cross-jurisdictional experience provides lessons that we should take into account when interpreting recent discussions surrounding Eurobonds or Corona bonds, or whatever you like to call them. Owen takes us through that. He takes us through the land bond experience and what he can tell us about the more recent EU experience. Finally, then we discuss how we can capture concepts of sustainability when measuring the standard of living. So we're all familiar with metrics such as GDP, but these do not take into account maybe environmental effects or how sustainable growth can be. And Owen takes us through research he has carried out on applying alternative methods to take into account these aspects of sustainability when measuring welfare through time. You can still find the Patreon at patreon.com/IrishEcomPod if you want to help to keep things going. As you know, this is a self-funded venture. I have to pay the bills myself, and some of those bills fell due last week. The Patreon really softened the blow, so thanks to everyone who helped keep this on the road. Okay, so without further ado, I'll leave you to my conversation with Owen. There's a lot of talk in the last while about the Spanish flu, because I suppose it's the last global pandemic that we've experienced. Maybe you could tell us a bit about just introduction and background to the Spanish flu and what exactly happened and how it maybe perhaps is similar to what we're experiencing at the moment with COVID.
Yeah, okay, so as you say, it's the last major pandemic. So like 20th century, we get three influenza pandemics, 1918. There's one in, I guess, 1957, one in 1968. But the 1918 one is off the charts. So this is the one like the epidemiologists go back to and study. This is the one like that, it's just so, it's such a major event. Like you can see it in life expectancy charts for the US, right? So there's a big dip around 1918. So it's a major event. First wave hits spring 1918. There's a second wave autumn 1918, and then there's a third wave in spring 1919. So the estimates are, the conservative estimate is about 20 million dead globally. The revised estimates are probably about 50 million, and these can go up to 100 million. So we're talking about, just a comparison at the time. So this is during World War One, tail end of World War One. 9 million war dead in World War One. So the Spanish flu kills more people than the war does. And the impact is extreme in some countries, and in other countries it doesn't seem to hit them as much, but it's global. So if it's a definition of a pandemic, it's a new strain of influenza, H1N1. It's something, so like there was an outbreak in, or kind of an epidemic, pandemic around 1890 of influenza, but this one is more severe. And if you go back, so like when I started looking into this, I was reading about global catastrophic risk. It was a brilliant book, very exciting. And it gives like the major pandemics of the past, you know, in recorded history. So like you're going plague of Justinian and about 25 to 40% population dead, all the way to influenza, 1918, Spanish flu. And Spanish flu is right there, which they reckon about, you know, mortality rates. The rates are hard to do because population estimates are very dodgy for this time. It's between two censuses, effectively, right? So normally you'd have a census 1910, and then you'd have another one 1920. For Ireland, we're on 1911, and the next one would have been 1921. And so you tend to just, a lot of these studies just look at the raw counts of people dead, but not the population, as a percentage of population. So it's hard to get a good figure on this. The other one that people compare to, so influenza is obviously it's a respiratory illness, but the more recent pandemic would be HIV/AIDS. So in this literature, you see a lot of people making comparison between what happened in 1918 and HIV/AIDS. So HIV/AIDS, there's different transmission, obviously, but it's the number of dead, the number of died from this is quite high as well. So this is about 25 to 65 million. So this is makes it into this global catastrophic risk kind of thing.
But your paper then is specifically looking at trying to estimate how many people were affected by the death count, basically, and trying to get a better estimate of the death count. Is that correct?
So the death count, but also as a rate. So what's the rate that died, and what's the variation across the country? So the thing for us was, when we're looking at this, we're looking, like a lot of the studies are US focused, right? So the US dominates this because it's such a big event in the US. For Ireland, there's not that much out there. So there was three PhDs done pretty much back to back. One looked at Munster, one looked at Leinster, one looked at Ulster, and then they try and merge it into the national picture. But these are pretty much kind of history of medicine focused or social histories. And then the only kind of study that's put it into econometric is it's Alan de Bromhead Fernihu. And they look at the 1918 election. So the election happens during the second wave. So that's in December 1918. And they see like, well, it doesn't affect the, so it affects the turnout, but not the result. But everyone's using the 1911 population as like a denominator. So if you're looking at rates, they're saying, well, compare it to 1911. But this is happening like 1918, 1919. Like it's happening a good bit away from when the census was. And then that kind of assumes that nothing happened in between. There's no conscription in Ireland, right? But in 1914, 15, you have a lot of enlistment. So this is where you get the volunteers, you get people in Dublin and Belfast signing up. So it makes a big impact on the population. And if you don't have a lot of men in the country, then it's hard to have kids.
So, yeah, fair point.
Yeah. It takes two to tango kind of thing, you know?
Okay.
So the birth rate goes down. So that was kind of something that's not really documented if you implicitly assume that there's no difference between 1911 population and 1918. So the composition of the population would change. So these are things that we thought if we use Ireland as a case study, we can highlight this. So Ireland is small. It's manageable. Like if you do the US, like that would take a bit of effort because, so what the US does, the US Census Bureau estimates population by state annually. And so they have annual estimates, but it's kind of effectively like linear interpolation. And they say around 1914, 15, the trends that we're using are based on the previous decade. So they're based on the 1900 to 1910 census. And in normal times, this might be a good approximation of what's happening to population. But immigration to the US is stalled because of the war. They're getting less immigration in. So this is going to distort. If you're using the previous decade's immigration trends, it's not the same. So they said, well, it's likely to be an under or overestimate in some states more than others. And if you look at by state, you see some states have really high immigration shares in 1910. So it would distort it. So like eventually, I guess someone will do it. It might be us, it might be someone else. But you go back to the US and do a more up-to-date estimate of the population so you can see what's going on. For Ireland, it's easy because it's 32 counties. We're talking small numbers. So if we make a mistake, it'd be noticeable and we can fix it. If we make a mistake in the US, like we mightn't spot it immediately, and then you know it could distort what we say. And if we get a paper out too quick, we might get the wrong message. Whereas this one, it's manageable, and we can make a kind of realistic assessment of what was going on.
So you want to compare it to the 1918 population. So how exactly do you go about doing that?
So the way can I just go back a bit to say why we care about this as well?
Sure.
We don't want just a total population. We want to look at the age groups. So we want to look at what age groups are affected. So in this literature, they're saying that it's people in the prime of their lives are the ones that are getting infected and dying. And so traditionally, like the flu pandemics affect the older population. So over 65s tend to get it and tend to, you know, have higher mortality from the flu. And when you go back to Ireland, like there's two epidemics before this. We have 1892 and 1900. And in those ones, it's over 55 population. So you can use, for those ones, they're really close to the census here. So you can use 1891 census, you can use 1900 census. There's no kind of war is going to distort that. And you can see like that the over 55s have a really high mortality rate compared to the other population. So what we want to do then is to look at the deaths by age. And part of the reason for this was to look at differences across counties in Ireland. So some counties have really high immigration traditionally, and they're left with an older population because like the younger population tend to be the ones that migrate. And then some places in the country like Dublin and Belfast tend to be younger. So there's, you know, do you have a higher death rate in Dublin because you have a younger population, more exposed than say you would in Mayo where they traditionally have higher immigration. So what we try to do then is to do age adjustment. So this is the thing that demographers do is you calculate the, you get death by age and you get the population of that age group and you weight it by a standard population. So for us, we calculated a population in 1911 using OECD population. So it weights the population by the size of, or the share of the groups in the population. And so if we do that, then we can make comparisons over time and space in Ireland to see what parts of the country did worse, what parts of the country did better. So that's the kind of, there are two reasons for doing this. So the existing literature doesn't estimate the population in 1918, uses 1911. And the other literature, they don't do age adjustments. So they don't compare, the age distribution. So like in mortality statistics, age is one of the biggest predictor of mortality. The older you get, the more likely something will kill you. We don't live forever, right? So something's going to get us. So that's kind of the reason we started doing this was to see, okay, so does this matter for Ireland? And if it matters for Ireland, then it has implications for everywhere else. And within Ireland, we see a lot of variation because of this tradition of emigration. So if you talk about the US, they have a tradition of immigration. Where the closest to like a US city would be Dublin or Belfast, because they're drawing migrants from different parts of the country. You'd also see it in the other cities in Ireland. So if you go down disaggregated, you'd see like different parts of the country have different kind of demographic compositions. And the other reason for doing this as well is because the literature is emphasizing different impact on sex, right? So men tend to be more affected than women in the literature. And so we want to see what's going on with this. So that's kind of like the motivation for doing it.
Right. And So we want to understand the effect, but we want to make sure that our figures aren't distorted by a certain location having too many old people. So for example, you might say, well, okay, a rural area like the west of Ireland might have a lot of old. You might think, well, we're doing really badly here, but we're doing badly here because there's a lot of old people here.
Yeah, and for the Spanish flu, it would be the opposite because it affects younger people. So if you have a younger population, you might be doing worse because you have a younger population than an area where the demographic isn't as affected. That'll be the motivation for doing this. The classic example of this, like they use the US, would be if you looked at Florida and Alaska.
Right.
So Florida gets a lot of retirees. Alaska doesn't.
Yeah,
but Alaska might look like it has, better death rate than Florida, but you have to compare like with like, and so age is a confounder here. So that is the motivation. If it matters for Ireland in this kind of case, it would matter for everywhere. That would be kind of the motivation.
Yeah, and it seems useful in two ways. I think for policy, one that you can sort of see the general effort, a bit better picture of the general effort if it's. How we're dealing with the issue. And secondly, if you compare the two, you can say, well, this is the effect age is having in different locations and give you and maybe pinpoint where you need to target areas where there might be, you know, more vulnerable populations or whatever.
Yeah, that's it exactly. So that's kind of what we want to do, and it's been missing in the literature. So it's not in the Irish literature, but it's not in any of the literature
right
for this. So the US studies, they look at raw death counts. The US studies that would use contemporary records are using a population that's been estimated using linear interpolation. The US estimates of flu don't use kind of age-adjusted mortality statistics, even though like the US are like some of the pioneers for doing this. The contemporary, like, so a lot of studies came out this year, like, We're not the first people to think of, wow, Spanish flu, we should do something with this. But the studies that came out, they're just using like data you can get off the CDC website.
So, okay, we have a good idea of why we're doing this. And you touched on some of the correction procedure. Maybe you could tell us a bit about that and then just maybe the findings you had on how this correction, how it affected your results.
So like all the time, statistical agencies will try and make population projections, usually after a census, so to get an estimate of what's happening in the population between census points. And it's standard demography. So what causes change in population, births, deaths, and migration, effectively. We use the annual vital statistics that are recorded. So these start from 1864. They get better over time. So Brendan Walsh had a paper looking, like this is a long time ago, but he looked at the kind of how accurate are the registrations compared to the census. So if you have registrations of births, how accurate is it compared to when the census says the number of people under one? So they would be the number of people born in a year. In 1871, there's a lot of variation between the registration and the census, but then by 1911, it gets a lot better. So these are the stats we're using. So we have annual births. The deaths are annual by age, so we take account of deaths by age. So we effectively subtract deaths from the age bands from the census. The other thing is the population ages by year, so we make adjustment for yearly aging. So, you know, a 29-year-old that's in the 25 to 30 would go into, 25 to 30. So if you're 30 in 1 year, you go into the next band next year, that kind of thing. And then migration. So we have these emigration stats. There's recorded emigration stats from people leaving the country. So we incorporate this in, and we know the age band of the emigrants. So we adjust the age bands using these contemporary records. The thing that we're kind of short on is immigrants coming into the country. So we use, there's a report on immigration in the 1950s, and they have some data on immigration. So we use this to supplement. But the thing for Ireland is it's net emigration. This is a period when still a lot of people go into the States. Historically, Ireland has some of the highest emigration rates in Europe. So it's a net emigration story, not a net immigration story. And we know where the immigrants come from, and we have a general idea where the immigrants will go to, so we can do that. This is, you know, we update this annually. So we go from, we start from the census, we go our way up to 1914, and then the war hits. So when the war hits, we need to have an idea of where enlistment happens in Ireland. So there is actually a lot of enlistments during this period. And we have some parliamentary papers that kind of give us an idea of where the distribution is. And we have an idea of the age group of soldiers. So soldiers tend to be between 18 and 40. So these are kind of like the ideal age group for soldiers. And so we have all these British parliamentary papers talking about it. What we do, though, is we only use enlistment in Ireland. So if you're an Irish immigrant and you go to Britain and you enlist in Britain, this would up the total number of Irish in the British Army, but it wouldn't. These people have already left Ireland, so they're already emigrating. So they're probably counted in the immigration, not in the enlistment. So that's why we have a lower total number of Irish recorded enlistment than would be, you know, the general view that there's about 200,000 Irish in the army at this point. Well, we get a lower number because they're enlisted in Ireland. And when they come back in, so they come back in, like once the war is over, there's demobilization. We have an estimate of how many Irish soldiers die. What's the death rate? So we apply this death rate to the soldiers returning. When like the contemporary records, they treat this as though it's emigration. So the soldiers emigrate, they go to France, they're gone, they're not in the population. And when they come back, it's kind of return migration. So today we call it a special population. So armies are considered like a special population that's different from the rest of the population because they tend to move around and be more mobile. So we do this annually. We update the ages annually, and this is how we get a 1918, 1919 picture. When we look at the deaths from Spanish flu compared to the population 1911 and population 1918, we get a different picture. We get the 1918 estimates show differences, especially under fives, because there's been a decrease in the birth rate. There's less children under five, and these children also experience high mortality. So then the death rate under five increases. For the middle population, we kind of see slight differences from 1911, but the biggest differences are in Belfast and Dublin, where the highest military enlistment was. So this is where we see Belfast and Dublin, the population, like we have these population pyramids in the paper, and it's very visible what's happening in Belfast and Dublin compared to the rest of the country. You see a segment of the population is gone. And so the other thing that we note as well, during the war, there's reserve occupations. So certain occupations are essential to the war effort. Agriculture is one of the main ones. You have to feed the army and the civilian population. So farmers in the countryside are reserved occupations, especially in Ireland.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ireland, but certain occupations in the cities are reserved occupations as well. And these are kind of, these are people of working age. They could have been in the military, but they're essential for maintaining the war effort. So they have to continue at home working in their occupations. And so we document that in the paper as well.
That's, yeah, okay. So maybe then, so you mentioned that you had some information then on how this relates to COVID. Maybe you could take us through that.
Yeah, so the discussion on COVID only looks, well, a lot of discussions just basically the count of the number of dead people from COVID, how many people have died, what's the cases. And when people are making comparisons between countries, they only say, you know, there's whatever cases per 100,000 population. But they don't say, like, what's the difference in demography of the countries. So this is something that's been picked up by demographers and health scientists. They were saying, well, you got to take account of the demography. So there's papers in the preceding National Academy of Science earlier in the year saying demography is going to be a big predictor of what's happened in COVID. So is the composition of the population, how the family structure. And this paper came out in April with Dowd et al. And then there was a response to this saying, well, actually, you have to take account of kind of the comorbidities in the population as well, and also take account of the age structure. So when we're doing this, so we did this for 1918 influenza just to see what was going on. But when you do it for COVID as well, so we're just using Ireland because Ireland's small. But for COVID, we have a nice kind of comparison here. We've got Republic of Ireland, Northern Ireland. So we look at March to June official stats of COVID deaths by age and sex. So we're able to do the same kind of age adjustment. The nice thing here is that the first case occurs around the same time in both Northern Ireland and the Republic. It's 27th of February in the North, 29th in February in the Republic. They both come back from Italy. So they both brought both COVID back from Italy. The lockdown, you know, social distancing, et cetera, happened earlier in the Republic. So this is the 12th of March. Northern Ireland had St. Patrick's Day, had a bit more fun for two more weeks, and then they had the lockdown. And then, like, the commentary in the newspapers, like, there was an Irish Times article saying, like, Northern Ireland is doing way worse. If we look at a crude death rate, Northern Ireland is 44.5 deaths from COVID versus 35.8 per 100,000 for the Republic. So if you just look at that, you say, wow, the South has done a much better job of managing COVID. So that's it, you know, case shut. But actually, that's not it. If you look at the stats, right, so the similar share of deaths in the over 65 population, 93.5 in the Republic, 92.8% in the North. So that's very similar. They're not that different in terms of who, like, the age groups that are dying from this. The big difference then is the North is older, so it has a higher share of the population in over 65s, so 15.8 versus 13.9%. If you age adjust, this is the thing I was mentioning earlier, so the simple age adjustment that I did here is Northern Ireland's older. What if it has the same population distribution as the South? So we weight all the COVID deaths by age band in the North by the South's population distribution. Well, when we do this, the North's age adjusted mortality is 35.6. If you remember that the Republic's the Republic's crude mortality rate is 35.8. So the North's actually doing better relatively to the Republic. So this isn't the narrative that's out there. The narrative is that the North has done worse. Within the UK, Northern Ireland is one of the better performers without taking account of age adjustment. So breaking it down even further, if you look at by the age bands, right, so 65 to 74, well, the North's mortality rate is 2.7% higher than the Republic's. If you look at the 74 to 85 band, the North is 2.4% lower. And then if you look in the distribution of deaths in the over 85s, the North rate is 5% lower than the Republic. So it's getting lower mortality in the groups that are most vulnerable to COVID. So it's not moot to say, you know, over 85s. These are like half the COVID deaths, pretty much. 45.3% of all the deaths of COVID are in this age band. So this is an important point that's not being made. So if you do this across countries, and this is, you know, kind of why some people are asking, well, how come Africa is doing so well at COVID? They have a lot of cases, but the mortality rate in Africa is lower than it is in Europe. So there's an article in Science that looked at this. And if you look at the distribution of ages, I think it was, they had Kenya, Malawi, the average age was about 20 versus Spain is probably 40 to 45. So this would account for why older population seems to be doing worse at COVID than younger. So if you want to make these comparisons across countries, you have to take account of the age differences in the population.
An interesting thing to take into account, because I suppose we're very conscious of the fact that interpreting the data that some countries have different measures than others, some countries have different amounts of testing than others. And that, you know, is a caveat that we all sort of, well, most people will bear in mind when reading the data, but we don't take into account, or demography is not as obvious, at least to most of us. So it's good to sort of highlight that.
The other thing I want to point out, so like 1918, so the studies are coming out saying, well, it didn't have a big impact on the economy as, say, COVID. Like COVID is causing major recessions. Like, so US is at depression level, unemployment. But 1918, like, it's kind of a blip. It's a small recession, if anything. And one of the things that happens here is this is early in, like, the epidemiological transition. Like, there's very high mortality rates in general compared to today. So, like, the Irish one, I think, is around 16 per thousand crude mortality in like the 1910s, whereas today it's 6. So we're in a high mortality environment in 1918. Today we're low mortality environment. So this is a pandemic that's happening in a low kind of mortality environment, which is very different to 1918. So that's something that doesn't get really discussed when people are making the comparisons between 1918 and today. And then 1918 is a very high mortality event as well. So we're talking, like, I looked up the global COVID mortality to date. It's less than 1 million, whereas 1918, the estimates are saying 30 to 50 million in an era when population levels were much lower. So this was, it's very difficult to make the comparison across time. And so the lessons that epidemiologists got from studying 1918 mightn't be as applicable today as they were in the past, right?
So the second part of our discussion covered Owen's work on land bonds in Ireland, another topic with contemporary parallels. So where Spanish flu research explored the impacts of the spread of a virus and how we measure the impact, this piece of research explores the impacts of an economic policy not dissimilar to the recent debate on euro bonds or corona bonds. So I'll drop you back into our discussion at the point where Owen is setting the scene on why exactly land bonds were issued in Ireland in the first place.
The context of this is the land war in Ireland and how the British state responded to the land war. So the first response was to lower rents for farmers, and the second response was to basically bail out the landlords. Give the farmers the ability to buy their land from the landlords and they won't have this conflict.
Right, so maybe you could just tell us what the land war was.
Going back a step. It's basically a conflict between farmers and tenant farmers and landlords at the end of the 1870s. So this is one of the first globalization shocks. It's very bad weather, 1877 to 79. There's some thing just relating back to the Spanish flu. When you look at year-to-year excess mortality, 1879 is one of the worst years since records began. If you look at by quarter, 1918, quarter four is really bad. But 1879 had like four back-to-back quarters of really bad excess mortality, probably some of the worst years since the actual famine in Ireland. And one of the things that's going on is that weather is bad, but there's a big increase in importation of grain from the Americas. And so prices go down. So farmers respond by saying, well, landlords, will you cut the rent, basically? And landlords are evicting this is a really bad period. Possibly, you know, rents are judged to be really high. You can make a comparison to today if you want. But no one's going out, you know, protesting at landlords. Landlords are getting shot. There's a lot of violence, threatening letters, etc. So this is, it's a very exciting period. This is like a social revolution. And the British state's response is first to lower rents. So you have these rent commissions that lower rents. And the second is to try and get rid of the problem once and for all by encouraging farmers to buy their land from the landlords. And to do this, you have to encourage the landlords to sell, and then you have to encourage the farmers to buy. So you have to create a situation where both are happy. And you need a lot of finance to do this. Instead of giving them cash, they gave bonds, so land bonds, were first issued in the 1890s. And so this is historically, 19th century, this is like some of the lowest interest rates in the end of the 19th century, which means that the price of the bonds were quite high. So if you're giving someone a bond to par, they're able to sell at 108, for example. So you make a profit off that. And so this kind of incentivized landlords to sell in the 1890s. So you see a lot of very commercially aware landlords selling up. But then the interest rates start to rise, bond prices start to go down. This is becoming less attractive. In 1903, this is the big land act, the Wyndham Land Act. The government introduces like a bonus for landlords for selling. So this is trying to replicate the conditions of the 1890s. And again, these are bond financed. And so the way it worked was the government would effectively issue these bonds. They could either be paid directly, pay the landlords directly in cash by floating the bonds in the market, getting cash for them and giving it to the landlords. Or they could issue bonds to the landlord and let the landlord deal with it. So you have a series of these issues of bonds. You got 1903, 1909, I think it's 1923, and there's a few more in the Free State. But what you see is a massive transfer of land ownership. You see, effectively, Ireland goes from being a land, you know, small number of landlords owning all land to a tenant farmer economy. So this is the only country in the UK where this happens. So the UK is willing to do this for the agricultural community. The agricultural community is effectively being, you know, this is an era of intense competition from globalization. You don't see it in Scotland. You don't see it in England. What you see in England is kind of market powers. So when value of land goes down, landlords are willing to sell, and farmers in England have the ability either to borrow or to have the capital on hand to buy their own farms. But you wouldn't see this in Ireland. There's kind of like a credit constraint. So the government comes in, it's able to borrow at low rates. It gives very long terms in these bonds. So they're effectively perpetuities, like the consols at the time. The loan term is about 68.5 years for farmers, so they're paying this back over a long period. The annuities that they pay are fixed, so these are, you know, depending on the prices of agricultural produce, this can be good or bad. If prices go up, it's good for farmers. If prices are going down, it's bad for farmers. So during the First World War, this is a great time for farmers. Prices are going up, but later you have deflation. Prices are going down. It's really bad for farmers. And during this time, the effect of these are guaranteed bonds. They're guaranteed by the British state, by the exchequer, and effectively treated as though they're sovereign debt. So when you look at the pages, the listings on the stock exchange, they're listed next to the various government issued debt at the time. So they're under guaranteed land stock. Derogatory term at the time was bog stock, because this is Irish bogs that are you're raising money for. This was a Tory term, like it was. So
I can imagine.
So basically, we look at bog stock over time, and so the neat thing about this, so this guarantee by the British state, well, Ireland secedes from the Union effectively, and so we have a lot of complexity here. So under like the original Government of Ireland Acts, the Irish government would have been absolved from any responsibility from collecting and handing over the money to the British state. But because of how things turned out, it's not really mentioned in the treaty. It's kind of ambiguous. We have a few deals in the 1920s, but it's kind of complicated then. So you have a guarantee from a British state. It's guaranteeing the debt of effectively farmers in the Republic. And it's the responsibility of the government to collect the repayments and transfer them to the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
And so that's one. So the pre-independence bonds are guaranteed solely by the UK government. And then the biggest spending of the Free State in the first few years. So just for a comparison, so the first national loan by the Free State is 10 million. The 1923 Land Act is about 23 million. And so this is necessary because of the, you know, people in the countryside are just taking farms, or the kind of the land conflict isn't really resolved. So you need this to restore order to the countryside. And the British government comes in as a co-guarantor on these bonds. So what we have is bonds that are issued guaranteed by the British state. And then we have these bonds that are either co-guaranteed or Irish guaranteed after independence. So we have a before and after, and we have like two different bonds that are kind of there. They have the same characteristics, but the guarantee is the only difference. The idea was to see, well, what happens with the guarantee? And so, like, I have this, you know, I collected this data from the Dublin Stock Exchange daily from 1890s up till 1938. And originally it was because there's no series of Irish bonds because, well, Ireland as a sovereign nation didn't exist until independence effectively. So this is kind of like getting a sense of what interest rates were going to be in Ireland. But I wanted to see what would happen like during the, you know, the revolutionary period. Like, did this go up, or, you know, is there a risk premium associated with Ireland? And so we compare the Irish bonds effectively with a risk-free asset, which is UK bonds. And we look at this over time. And effectively what we do is just look for structural breaks. And we limit the sample period to, you know, 1920 to 38 to keep it clean. And we find three structural breaks. So we find one during the revolutionary period. There's a bit of uncertainty about what's going to happen. And we see like kind of a premium on land bonds throughout the 1920s up until 1932. When the really exciting thing happens is when Dev decides he's not going to repay the annuities. And this is effectively the first default of the Republic. It, like a lot of people like to say, it's not a default, but it's according to the definitions of a sovereign debt default by, you know, refusing to honor obligations. Is, you know, it is a default. But once this happens, the British government steps in straight away and honors the guarantee. And once they honor the guarantee, the premium is gone on those bonds. So that's the nice thing.
So just to break it down, the premium then is like, or the interest rate is a proxy for how risky the investment is and what the belief is that it'll be repaid, I suppose. So if you see a premium, it's how the markets perceive the risk associated with this bond, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. So this bond is effectively, it's backed by the land. So like if farmers don't repay their farms will be repossessed. And so it's kind of secure because farmers don't want their land being repossessed. So you see very few defaults on the loans. Yeah. There shouldn't be that much uncertainty because the majority of this debt is owned in the UK by UK institutions. There's effectively a currency union between the two. So there's no exchange rate risk. You have free trade between the two countries. So there shouldn't be any risks there. You have integrated factor markets like labor. It's free to move between both. And there's strong political institutions in Ireland. They're actually replicating what the existing institutions from the UK. And there's an awareness that there will be sanctions if farmers refuse to repay. And then there's a guarantee from the UK that it will guarantee these bonds if anything happens. So really, according to the theory on debt mutualization, there should be no risk premium on this. There should be zero. But we find the non-negligible risk premium associated with this. So it's something else. And we think it's the uncertainty about the guarantee. The guarantee isn't really hashed out. Like, who's going to guarantee this if anything happens? Because in the old regime, it was pretty clear it was a UK-issued debt. But now it's an independent country operating by itself. It starts to raise its own, issue more debt. So this is an issue in the literature about the kind of moral hazard associated with this, or debt dilution, that a country, if you guarantee one country, it might issue more debt. And then the likelihood of it prioritizing the kind of debt mutualized the mutualized debt will be lower for it. So it might be, you know, be strategic and just take advantage. So this kind of moral hazard will creep in. Like the fact that the break happens bang on when Dev is, it's not like it's a shock. He campaigns on this. Yeah. He states he's going to do it. So the British state has a good time to realize what's happening. And they instantly, like, there's parliamentary evidence, like it's in newspapers, reports on this. Like the really cool thing about this is, like, there's records from the cabinet called the Irish Situation Committee. And they talk about how they'll give, basically a press release saying what they're going to do. And they say, well, we're going to say we're going to honor this. And once they do that, like, that's it. The uncertainty about the guarantee is gone. And they honor the repayments as soon as. So bondholders, they get their, you know, they get their dividends when the time comes. There's nothing happening. So there's no premium on them then.
This is actually, it reminds me of the whole, I know we're going to, there's parallels here with the COVID response, but it reminds me of what happens with Brexit, because, and you look at the value of sterling, and when there's uncertainty around Brexit, the value of sterling fluctuates a lot. And then once there's an announcement made, be it it's a hard Brexit or it's no Brexit, well, if there was one of no Brexit, it seems to settle a bit. So it's the uncertainty that drives a lot of these fluctuations. And it seems to be here, it's the uncertainty that's driving the risk premium when it comes to the bonds.
So it's just the, the credibility, right? So you don't really know until an action is taken. So that's kind of why I'd be a bit worried about Eurobonds. So the European Union would come out and do some, you know, they make a grand gesture, they'll do this. The European Commission has said they're going to borrow, 750 billion. But have they put the thought into how they'll implement this in practice? So, like, it's all well and good with the euro. It looked like it was well designed, but there are structural flaws with the euro, and these weren't taken into consideration. If you do the same thing again, will you just create this uncertainty? And you're right, the same point with Brexit. There's just a lot of uncertainty, and it keeps going until something is concrete and done. Like, so pretty much after Brexit, like, sterling dropped, it fluctuated wildly, depending what was said. The same kind of thing would happening.
I suppose it's underappreciated sometimes that the uncertainty itself it can be a problem. And this comes out in this case. Did you have any further effects then that you want to go through? Or?
Yeah, so we did two things. We did the structural break, and then we looked at a difference in difference effectively. So we looked at the two types of bonds. So the ones that guarantee by the British state solely, and the ones that have like an Irish guarantee. And we did a narrower period, like I think it was 1926 to 38. But when we did this, we see like that the risk premium associated with the UK guaranteed goes away effectively when the guarantee is implemented. But then the kind of uncertainty on the Irish ones went up a bit. Right. So that was interesting. The other thing I should say about this is what happens. This is all this is messy, right? So Dev defaults at the same time pretty much as the UK war loan is being restructured. So the UK war loan is massive. This is another one that could be classified as a default. So the UK restructures this entire war loan because it's a massive burden on the state. This happens the same time. The way we get around this is, Ograda has a book, in his book, he looks at the bond prices in Ireland relative to Britain. And he says it's mainly it's being driven by Fianna Fáil uncertainty. So that's kind of like support for this. And the other stuff, we have all this contemporary records of the government talking about how to respond. And we think that there is like the link might be that the UK government is unwilling to default on the land bonds itself. So it didn't have to honor the guarantee. Like it could have said, you know what, that's land in Ireland, let's, you know, leave it. But they're trying to restructure the war loan. They need the financial institutions in the UK, which hold a lot of land bonds, to, you know, to participate and kind of engage with this process. So this could be why they don't allow the Republic to default. At the same time, another thing happens is like Newfoundland has this, they're struggling as well. So the response, if you compare the response of the British government to Ireland versus what happens in Newfoundland, is very interesting as well. So that's it. The other thing, I guess, is this kind of strategic default. by Fianna Fáil and De Valera. It's brilliant, right? Because they're thinking about it. They know that the British government won't, well, their anticipation, the British government won't default because they've too much to lose from this. Whereas, you know, if we default, what's the worst that can happen? Obviously, the trade war is a result of this. Like, British yeah. government tries to recoup some of the money somehow. But De Valera knows that, you know, Britain's going to pick up the tab, so why not? So, like, as I said before, like, these bonds are, like, really, like, they're going for, like, 68 years. So he doesn't say farmers don't have to stop paying it. He says you only have to pay half of what you were paying, and you still pay it to the government. So it turns into a land tax rather than an annuity repayment. And when the government makes a settlement in 1938, it's a great settlement for this. So this is the 1938 settlement. They settled for way less than what is outstanding. So it's really great kind of political move. So, like, Kevin Rourke's got a great paper about the economic war, and he sees, like, basically it's a Fianna Fáil coup in this respect.
The game theory going on there is very interesting, or the moral hazard. Okay, so maybe if we have 10 minutes or so, just, I know you've done some work on measuring sustainability. If you could just give us a bit of a whistle stop on that, or on one thing that anyone who's done, say, environmental economics would be familiar with, the whole concepts of weak sustainability versus strong sustainability and what it means going forward and how to measure this. Maybe you could tell us a bit about your work on this area and how you give insight into basically how sustainable growth is going forward.
Yeah, so the big distinction between kind of environmental economics and ecological economics is this weak versus strong sustainability, right? So weak sustainability, we think about the total capital of you know, whatever you're looking at, if it's the world or if it's a country or a region, and your total capital is comprised of reproducible capital. So this would be like factories, machines, your natural capital. So these are like all gifts of nature, renewable, non-renewable, etc. Human capital, institutional capital. The main distinction or the assumption that weak sustainability makes is that you can substitute different forms of capital. So if you run down, say if you're Venezuela, you run down $100 of oil, you can reinvest that, or you should reinvest it like later. That's kind of one of the assumptions, into another form of capital, right? So that $100 of oil goes into $100 of education. And that's kind of a key thing. The other thing is that you can put a price on everything. You can put a dollar value or euro value on all your natural capital. The strong sustainability tends to say, actually, there are critical thresholds. Once you go below this, you're kind of, this is existential risk, basically, that, you know, you might be able to live. You know, if you undermine ecosystem services enough, these provide the oxygen for us to breathe, and we won't be able to breathe. That's kind of fundamentally where it would lead to. The other thing is that, you know, it's not substitutable. If you cut down a forest for pastoral agriculture, you can't replace that. You can't substitute it with human capital or education. And also the last one is that you can't really put a dollar value on some of these things. Some of these things are priceless, and it's very hard to put a price on it. So that is the main distinction. Within this literature, like, my argument here would be, so we're kind of testing for whether or not there's a weak or, you know, if a country is weak, sustainable. If you fail this test, well, you're not going to pass a strong sustainability test, because it's really saying what's happening with your natural capital. And so if your natural capital is being undermined, if it's not being reinvested, you'll fail this weak sustainability test, and you'll also fail a strong sustainability test. So strong is like, effectively, it's a stronger test of sustainability than the weak. But there is this big debate then between ecologists and economists over what one to focus on. So one of the papers we have on this, it's in the Oxford Review Economic Policy. We look at natural capital stocks. And so there's two ways to do it. One way is you look at the discounted value of rents of your of your natural capital. The other way is to look at the stock of capital, what's happening with the stock of capital, and value it using like a kind of a price, not market price, but a shadow price of capital. So you kind of incorporate it, but I guess you're never going to please all the people all the time.
So basically, you're trying to test if there's weak sustainability as the lower threshold. And if you find weak sustainability, well, then we can look and see if there's strong sustainability. But first of all, I have to see if there's weak sustainability in the first place.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, I think it's straightforward to find, like, to get the data for weak sustainability. The strong sustainability requires a lot more more data. So it tends to focus on like physical indicators. So like what is the biodiversity in an area? All this. So this would be more kind of ecology based work to estimate that.
Right. Okay. So you're just, it's more of an accounting. In my mind, it sounds like it's more like an accounting exercise. You sort of take out, well, that's probably very much underestimating the amount of work that goes into it. But I mean, you're calculating the different elements of capital and seeing how the total changes through time. Would that be correct?
Yeah, that'll be exactly it. So, like, I didn't invent this. This builds on a lot of work from a lot of. There's a strong theoretical foundation for all of this stuff. Like the intellectual origins, I would say, go back to Solow's original growth model. Then you have the oil shocks, and so like you come out with limits to growth. So this comes out in the 70s. This is like, you know, the ultimate apocalyptic model, basically saying we're doomed. And I think it's around 2000, if I remember, or maybe it's a bit later. But this overshooting collapse. So that basically we're using up too much resources. This comes out around the same time as the oil shock. So it really scares people. And Solow comes up with a kind of augmented Solow model where he incorporates natural capital. And so he says himself that he was influenced by limits to growth. He doesn't say anything nice about the limits to growth, but he says it was influential. And then so like the intellectual origins of all this stuff, it's from the 1970s. It's Solow, Heal, Stiglitz, and Sen. And then the major kind of intellectual powerhouse for this approach, I guess, would be John Hartwig. So he's got an American Economic Review paper, which effectively says if you reinvest your rents from natural resources, you can have kind of sustainable growth. And so Solow said later that if he had thought about it, he would have done what Hartwig did. And so they kind of have this kind of shared intellectual lineage with growth accounting. The difference here, the theories tend to focus more on well-being. So it's all about, how can we maintain our well-being or utility or improve it from generation to generation. So it's intergenerational well-being, whereas growth is about how can we grow the economy. But they're similar but distinct, I would say.
That's actually useful with think about it in that we're trying to see can we sustain intergenerational well-being as opposed to growth. In some of your papers then you've tested this week's sustainability and what did you find? Were you able to find weak sustainability or evidence that would suggest that there's weak sustainability?
Yeah, so just kind of explain how you do the test because it's a bit... It might come across a bit convoluted or complicated. It's a very simple test. Like, so the original paper was by Kirk Hamilton. What's it? Hamilton and Ferreira Vincent. And so they looked at this. So Kirk Hamilton was the chief environmental economist at the World Bank. And the World Bank has been the leaders in doing these kind of studies on how you measure sustainability, how you measure the wealth of nations today. And the way they do it was you have your sustainability indicator. How does it relate to future well-being? And so for economists, the way to measure well-being is usually in terms of consumption per capita or real wages. So we looked at the discounted present value of changes in consumption over time. So if you do this, say, for 20 years or 50 years or 100 years, that's the kind of calculation. When the studies that Ferreira Hamilton Vincent did, so they did a bunch of, I think it started off as global in one of the first papers, and then it was narrowed down to a sample of developed countries. If you do this over time, They, you know, hopefully you'd find a one-for-one relationship between the indicator of sustainability and future well-being. Or the, so that'd be like the strongest test you can do. Or as you improve your measure of sustainability, so it's genuine savings in the literature. If you improve this, if you add more things in, will it become a better predictor of future well-being? So if you do it modern, because this is over 20 years or 30, 50, we can't really test it with modern data because the data they're all getting is from like the World Bank database. Some of it starts in 1970s, some of it starts in 1980s. It's over 20-year period. So what we did then was go back in time. So can you look at this for like the best one would be the UK because you have people have been collecting data going back to the Industrial Revolution. If you do this test for the UK over, you know, different time horizons, what happens if you incorporate different aspects of capital into your estimators, what happens? And what we tend to find is that the over the long run, this is a good predictor. So over like 100 years, this is a really good predictor of future well-being. So the testing is kind of like it's straightforward enough. You only have two variables. You just want to see if there's a relationship. So just testing the theory. The theory set an infinite time for it's basically saying that your consumption your utility is based on your performance in this sustainability indicator, and so over 100 years is a real good approximation of that. And for the UK, we do see evidence. We see like these two series are co-integrated, and so that's kind of our basis for saying this is a good indicator of future well-being. So it could be a good predictor. So we use kind of like in-sample prediction, basically, see how it performs within the sample. If you're like, if you're just using the theory today, we can't really say much about 50 years in the future. So we could be adopting a model that doesn't really work. Whereas if you go back 1760, predict to 1860, and this thing works, and if it works down from 1860 to 1960, this is a good indication. This is the good predictor. So we do find evidence. The caveat, I guess you probably get to this, is you got to put in TFP to get there.
Okay, total factor productivity. So that's
total factor productivity. Yeah.
So that's technology, essentially.
Yeah. So this is the black box. We don't know what it is, but it works. So this comes from like a paper, Weitzman. So Martin Weitzman, he's one of the main guys in this. If you want to see, like, you know, people listening to this want to know what exactly I'm on about. He has a few years ago, he presented at this wealth conference and he gave one of the best presentations of this theory, real simple one in 20 minutes. And everyone who walked away with it thought they understood everything. But then you try and replicate what he did and you're like, wow, how did he do it? But he's one of these guys. He had like a paper in Quarterly Journal of Economics and he had another one in the Swedish Economic, Swedish Economic Review, like pretty decent places. And his main point was, you have to incorporate TFP because this is one of the major sources of growth for developed countries. The reason why it doesn't work for, if you don't incorporate it, you're only just measuring capital and different types of capital, but you're not incorporating TFP, you're missing what's driving growth. And so once he incorporates it, he has like back of the envelope calculation that pretty much TFP will predict future sustainability. The logic would be that it's kind of like incorporating the value of time, that we're able to get more from our assets over time. We've just become more efficient at using things. And so when we put this in for UK, we see the same kind of scenario that Weitzman was predicting, that TFP is a major driver of this, which is a good and a bad thing, right? Because if you tell people today TFP is going to predict your future sustainability, people say, well, what exactly is it or how do we get to it?
Yeah, so essentially, but the message I hear then is it's a level of technology. So we should be investing in technology to be sustainable. But that would be very much in line with the weak sustainability argument in that we can substitute away from rainforests towards whatever other sort of man-made technology we could have. But in it's another step then to think about, well, what are the implications in terms of strong sustainability?
Yeah, so this is where a lot of criticism will come in, that a new technology might have an unintended consequence, that it might, you know, might solve one problem and create another. We can think of an example of diesel cars for that. Like this was an idea that was supposed to address climate change, we end up creating like pollution problems with that, an unintended consequence that deals with one problem. So a lot of the strong sustainability kind of advocates would say this is a problem. When you just think about technological solutions, you don't think about that it creates a new problem, so to speak.
Okay.
So yeah, that's definitely an issue. And then the other issue is, well, how exactly are you measuring TFP? So when we, like, I have another paper, we use German data just to test it out. But if you use different measures of human capital in TFP, you can lower the residual, and then that should, the lower the residual, the better, right? Because then you're trying to incorporate everything that you know about. And it still does pretty well over a long time period with that. So that, that was kind of reassuring in some sense.
Yeah, so lowering the residual, you're explaining more of the variation of what's going on. That means you're capturing this effect better, essentially.
Yeah, that's kind of like what we're hoping to do. So we've been doing this for different countries. I should say, Christian Ducoyne and myself, and Les Ockley, we're looking at global sustainability. So we're looking at different countries, different periods of time. The idea here is that basically we'd have an indicator that can compete with GDP to measure the economy over time. So this is something like, you know, this Stiglitz-Sen-Fitoussi Commission that was commissioned by Sarkozy in France a few years ago. They're advocating we should have a broader measure of the economy, not just focus narrowly on GDP. And so we're trying to do this historically for as many countries as possible. So some of the issues in this, like, it is very interesting literature because you're dealing with, effectively, you're saying that if you use up your natural capital, this will lead to unsustainability. If we take the history of the UK, for example, the UK starts to import a lot of natural capital from other parts of the world. And so if you look at modern day indicators, the exporters of natural capital perform very poorly compared to the importers of natural capital.
When you say importing natural capital, do you mean things like importing cotton for linen and stuff like that?
I would incorporate that somewhat, because, but that's renewable, so it would have an impact on the soil or
oil.
More like resources. Oil, more like oil, kind of minerals, that kind of exports.
Right.
So like there's some good papers. The kind of big proponents of this, there's the World Bank approach and then the United Nations Environmental Programme, United Nations Development Programme have these rival. So it's World Bank, UN, the Washington versus New York dissent kind of approach. But the UN ones are very interesting. They try and deal with these issues of like, where is the trade aspect of this? And one of my co-authors, Louis Dupuis, he has kind of a few papers on this from his PhD, where he looks at how trade fits in with this, because it's not very straightforward. You know, you can do this accounting, but you need to account for other things. So people have been doing this for like CO2 emissions. You know, where exactly are our carbon emissions if we've exported manufacturing to other countries and we import the manufactured goods, our carbon emissions are lower, but the other people's or other countries' emissions are higher as a result. It's that kind of thinking about this. Does Ryan also want to say, I guess like the other things we incorporate are pollution into this. So if you compare with GDP, GDP wouldn't incorporate, externality. So if there's any pollution as a byproduct, it's not really incorporated. The cleanup gets incorporated, like that might boost GDP. But what we do, or what the World Bank's done, is try and incorporate, say, you know, carbon emissions into genuine savings. And so we've tried to do this, like we did it with carbon emissions going back historically using like social cost of carbon. So this is kind of like what Richard Toll was doing. So, you know, bring those prices back to the 18th century. And then more recent work, I guess, so Luke McGrath, Stephen Hines have done for Ireland is incorporate a whole basket of pollutants and what happens when you incorporate these into your sustainability indicators. Like, what's the message if you have different pollutants? So that's quite interesting. The other ones, population growth. How do you incorporate population growth over time? So really, we're talking about wealth. And so your wealth's distributed amongst more people. So it's kind of getting diluted. So what happens if you incorporate population growth? What's the message like? So you can see this touches on lots of issues in environment and development.
So basically just capturing all these other effects to get a better measure of how the standard of living or welfare has changed throughout the years. Coming back to the trade issue, so you're saying that countries that import natural capital perhaps fared a bit better. So basically, they're getting the benefit of this natural capital they're importing, but they're better than the countries who are exporting. I wonder why that is. That's sort of...
It's down to the accounting, right? So
right.
The level of aggregation for this is at the nation state. So if you're exporting, we even within our time period, like Britain was exporting coal, but the extraction of coal comes in Britain and we subtract that from British savings. But if it goes to Belgium or if it goes to Denmark, Denmark's getting this coal and we don't make any adjustments on to Denmark or Belgium, for example. So that's what we're doing. But if you scale it up to the global level, it should all even out. Like you're extracting natural capital at global level. Yeah. So this is another debate is what's the level of aggregation we should really consider? So Pezzi and Burke have this really, really nice paper where they look at what happens if we do global genuine savings, if we recalibrate the Nordhaus, the ICE model to have optimal controls or no controls. And then what happens if we have this big giant global cost of carbon? So like carbon is, it's a global pollutant. It doesn't matter where you emit it, it has an effect everywhere. But if you're only accounting for your carbon emissions, like at a national level, it might make much of an impact, but globally, this is where the impact comes. So globally, yeah, you scale up, all these issues with trade would go away. But then the problem becomes, well, how do you actually address a problem? If you notice that it's unsustainable, well, who's going to take action? And it's national governments that really, at the end of the day, are the ones that are sovereign and have the ability. So that's the limitation of that. But it does give a better sense of what's happening. So their major finding, I think, was that once you take account of kind of global emissions, and if you change the social cost of carbon, they have a really pessimistic one, worse than Stern. But yeah, I think it was showing genuine savings to be more in line with ecological indicators, which are very pessimistic about, the ecological impact of economic activity. So that's kind of an interesting one.
Okay. I think I've taken up a lot of your time now, Owen. I think we've covered everything there anyway. So thanks a million.
No problem. Thanks to you.
So my thanks to Owen and thanks to everyone for listening. If you want to keep the show on the road, the Patreon site at www.patreon.com/IrishEconPod is where you can throw a few shillings in the tip chair. And that's about it. So I'll talk to you then in 2 weeks' time.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.